I don't think a lot of people realize how much goes into the planning and development of a vineyard.
And I look at Sauvignon Blanc too, as it can be very transparent of the farming style.
A lot of people don't realize Sonoma County is 1 million acres. Makes us about the size of Rhode Island as a state.
For most people who are really into wine, being a wine dude, a wine nut, or whatever you want to call it, I think they all have a wet dream to make their own wine eventually.
I really have fun with doing my job, with doing wine, with being viticulturist.
You know, to stay out of the vineyard, I only have the shotgun for the boar, and I'm thinking, great.
As much as I love Chardonnay, I didn't want to spend my nights worrying about it and my days talking about it.
I worked 14 hours the day before I went into labor. I was determined to get most of that Chardonnay in.
In another beautiful, sunny day in Napa Valley, in a room full of half crazy, half passionate people. I mean, how bad could it be?
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 196. This week we feature Susie Selby of Selby Winery in Sonoma. The beauty of a small winery is focus on quality with a hands-on approach. Susie Selby of Selby Winery in Healdsburg knows all about that approach. Susie is the owner, winemaker, and head of sales for Selby Winery. You can't get much more hands-on than that. Susie was visiting Wisconsin, the home of Life Between the Vines, and we managed to get a bit of her time to talk about her personal wine journey. Small is good. Well, we're here at the studios of Life Between the Vines here in Milwaukee, and we're here with Susie Selby of Selby Winery. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you.
Thanks for coming by today.
Well, my first trip to Wisconsin has been wonderful. I'm a huge fan of this city.
Really?
Yes.
It's not a bad city, and it's becoming a wine-drinking city, slow but sure, isn't it?
Very much so. I mean, I've always heard great things about it, and I finally got to experience some of the local culture. I had a photo in front of the beautiful museum. I still haven't had my cheese curd yet, but my fried cheese curd, but I'm looking forward to it. But the people have been absolutely wonderful, and the food's been fantastic.
Good. Well, the food is pretty darn good around here. It's changed a lot over the years. And you were in Madison, too, you said, right?
Yes, I was in Madison, and tomorrow I will be in Green Bay.
Cool.
And I can't wait to see Lambeau Field.
Well, that's changed.
One of the few sports fans in the wine industry.
Are you seeing more wine drinkers in the Midwest these days?
Well, absolutely. And my parents are both from South Bend, Indiana.
Oh, cool.
And I went to high school in Indiana. And so things seem to start on the East and West Coast and sort of work their way in. But I think Midwesterners have a fine appreciation for food and wine and really appreciate the fact that we're getting more eclectic varietals and more chefs involved. And, you know, there's a lot happening in the food and wine scene here.
Oh, yeah.
It's exciting.
Changing radically, yeah.
Well, it's pretty exciting what's happening nationally with the wine industry. There's wine, I believe, in every state now.
It is every state. And I'm not sure, but I think even vineyards being grown in every state, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe so.
Which is pretty astounding because when you think of Anchorage, you don't think about.
No, no. No, and I think sometimes people are a little harsh on wineries that are in states other than California, Oregon, and Washington. But truly, people are doing a very good job, especially with what they have to work with. And we're so spoiled in California because we have the soil and the climate, and we even have significantly better access to equipment because it's all based there. So, you know, I applaud the winemakers in other places who are doing what they're doing because they're typically doing a very good job with what they have to work with.
Well, and the thing is, too, is you have a workforce there, which is helpful. And I know a lot of areas, especially in the Midwest, you know, some people are using using mechanical pickers because it's simply too difficult to get a workforce in some of those areas.
Well, then what you're seeing in those areas is a glimpse of what's happening in California. And I believe, given our limited workforce now, we're slowly moving to mechanical harvesting. And I believe within the next 10 years, it's going to be primarily mechanical, which is, you know, it's important to embrace changes. But it's sort of sad to see the change.
Yeah, because so many of these people who work in the fields, work in the vineyards, I mean, these are people whose families have been doing it for a long, long time. It really is truly in their blood, not to use the cliche.
No, and it's generations of families. And, you know, I have to say that the biggest love I have of the wine industry is that it's an amazing combination of art, science, and nature. And we have virtually been unchanged by technology. And I have equipment that I bought in 1998 that will be fine. It will not go obsolete in my entire lifetime. And it's a manual, you know, it's a lot of manual labor, a lot of little decisions. But you know, when all is said and done, computers don't change how our wines taste, and technology doesn't change. And so it's almost like we're a little tiny corner of the world that is not moving with everyone else. And I just think it's wonderful.
I think it's a nice thing. I have to say, I'm glad the computers aren't changing the way wine tastes. That would be bad.
I know. And actually, the fourth element of wine that I'll bring up, that's what I'm extremely passionate about, is history. You know, the history of wine is pretty amazing. It's basically 4,000 years of fermentation. And I feel honored to even be part of that. Truly, it's neat.
You're part of that chain, that goes back, that's not only deep in history, but it's different continents.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's fun. So the whole industry is exciting. And, you know, I really mostly embrace those elements of it.
That's nice. Well, let's talk about your story. One thing I was reading about, which was interesting, and I'll see if I can say this right. Your dad was a helicopter combat surgeon.
He was in Vietnam.
I don't think you can get much tougher than that in terms of occupations.
No, my dad was an amazing man, very much a Renaissance man. He was a doctor. He was one of the premier spine surgeons in the United States, and he was a war hero in Vietnam. He also liked the arts. He was a clay sculptor and a marble sculptor. And, you know, one is additive and one is subtractive, so he definitely used all parts of his brain, and he was funny. He had a great sense of humor, but he really loved wine, and he really loved food and wine. And I think the biggest gift now that my dad gave me, it wasn't just the passion for wine and food, it was the exposure to wine and food. And because of his national presence or international presence, my parents exposed me to food from all over the world and wine. And I did start enjoying wine at a very, very young age, as did my sisters. So we've always had an appreciation for it.
How young was that?
You know, I'm sure I started enjoying. I'm saying enjoying instead of drinking. Doesn't that apply to me? I'm sure I started enjoying wine. We always had wine at the table growing up. It's almost like the Italian concept, sure. But we would always have a glass of wine at Christmas or Thanksgiving. And if we ever wanted to taste something or smell something, my parents always let us do that and encouraged it.
As it should be, because you learn from that and you do get more of a cultural appreciation for what else is going on in your world and around you in the world.
Well, yes. And I just, you know, wine is just held such a, it's an important part of, again, I go back to history, but part of a meal and part of enjoying something together. It's just a lifestyle, I think. Not that it's a lifestyle at 13, but but it is. Eventually, it's a addition to a good lifestyle.
Sure, sure. And it does bring people together, not just family, but people together in general, plus conversation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. That's a big deal.
So did you start the winery with your dad, or was that on your own?
My dad and I started it together in 1994. And he was still practicing medicine in Dallas, and he would come and help me blend and do things like that. But at the time, I was working for a larger winery, and I started out by working in the taste room. And I was working there because my dad and I wanted to start Selby together someday. But I worked in a tasting room. I learned how to drive a forklift and became the warehouse manager. And then I started working in the cellar and became a cellar master, and then became the assistant winemaker.
So you really have taken the classic path for becoming an owner.
I have. I mean, what I had working was an apprenticeship. And the nice thing now as the owner of a winery is I've worked every job. And I know, for instance, that it's harder to work in the tasting room than it is to work in the cellar. So my perspective is pretty good. And, you know, and I guess when at the end of the day, I've done all the jobs and I can do all the jobs, but I think it helps have a better relationship with employees when they know you've done it all yourself.
Yeah, because you can relate to them.
Oh, yeah. And I know what they should be doing and how hard it is. And there are so many jobs that seem easy and they're just not. Hospitality is very challenging. And I think a lot of owners, if they haven't experienced that, don't really appreciate what a key job that is and how difficult it is.
Sure.
But, you know, back to my background, after my dad and I started this, and my mother was involved as well, and my sisters, but my dad passed away unexpectedly of a brain aneurysm.
Oh, geez, I'm sorry.
In 1997. And my mother really felt that she should not be getting involved in something risky, which was the wine industry, and my sisters didn't want to be involved. So basically, I just decided to do it on my own. And my dad didn't invest at that point. So I just figured out a way and I rented a warehouse and I did what I had to do and I kept making wine and kept working at the larger winery. And after all those years, I made it work. But I feel fortunate that I had that experience because it makes me appreciate where I am today.
Oh, yeah, I'll bet. What year is it you started Selby again?
1994.
Okay, so I'm kind of curious about the future, looking at this time, which was 22 years ago. Did you ever dream the future of wine would go the direction it's gone and how big wine has become?
No, I had no idea, quite honestly. I knew I loved what I was doing, and every day was a great day when I was making wine. Now, sometimes every day is not a great day when you're trying to sell wine. That's a whole different issue, but I always embraced every day. And I didn't think that far into the future at the time, but wine has become big. And it's I'm amazed looking back at the number of brands that are out there and the dynamics and the consolidation. You know, I when I meet with salespeople, I like to tell them that, you know, I'm the reason that you fell in love with wine, you know, not me personally, but
sure.
But every person who is selling wine or a food and beverage manager involved in wine, they all typically liked it because they saw, you know, the little people who were out in vineyards and in a cellar. You know, it wasn't because of the large wineries of this world. And because of how things have changed, selling wines or even buying wines from the little people like me is sort of a luxury. And people don't forget that.
No, they don't. About how many cases are you making?
Well, I was as high at one point as 30,000. I'm down right now to about 13,000. And I'm smaller because I'm making a lot of varietals and I make too many varietals probably. I make 16 different wines in the tasting room. And I do it because I can. I mean, since the advantage I have is I'm the owner and the winemaker and the national sales manager. So nobody can complain.
You've got those hats. Yeah.
I know. If I decide I want rosé because I love rosé in the summer, then I just make it.
Yeah.
And it makes it more fun.
Yeah, okay. Maybe you make too many, but is that such a bad thing for your clientele? I'm sure they enjoy the fact that they have variety to choose from.
They do. They love it. And I'm not trying to be something for everyone. I'm just trying to be everything for myself.
You obviously love wine.
I love wine. I love making it. You know, it's always nice to have a new challenge. I mean, I have been told that to be a great winemaker, you need to narrow down your focus and just do one or two wines. I, of course, have been told that by winemakers who, guess what, do one or two wines.
Yeah.
But I just find it, more challenging and fun and it makes it an interesting tasting experience as well.
I bet it does. Why don't you walk through what you make? Obviously, I saw that you, we have in here in the booth with us, we have a Sauvignon Blanc and we also have a Petit Sirah, which is one of my favorites. So what else do you make?
Well, I make Chardonnay, Cabernet, Zin, Merlot, Sangiovese. I used to make a Dolcetto, but the vineyard is gone. Carignan, a lot of Zin, a lot of big concentrated Zins, Pinot Noir. And my favorite Pinot that I make is called Calicary Vineyard from my favorite growers. They're just wonderful people. And The French have a saying that the best grapes have the best views, and that's this vineyard. It's wonderful. I also do some late harvest Gewurztraminer and port and Petit Verdot, Malbec. It's a pretty big list.
You're not missing anything, really, not that I'm thinking about.
Well, if I think of it, I'll try to find it.
Yeah, that's very impressive. Sangiovese is great. I'm a big Sangiovese fan. Now, do you own vineyards at all?
I do not.
Okay, so you're pretty much leasing everything you do.
Well, I have contracts with growers, and most of my contracts are long-term contracts. It's very important to have a good relationship with the grower, more so than it seems. I insist on being part of the process in the vineyard, and that can be challenging. There's an inherent conflict between wineries and growers, sure, because growers, of course, want larger quantities for financial reasons, which is perfectly understandable. And winemakers want smaller quantities for quality reasons. And so finding a balance is really important. And I think working with growers for as many years as possible is important. And I have growers I've worked with for all the 20 years I've been making wine. And it's exciting. And I think it's important that we stick together through good times and bad times, because sometimes every time it's good for the grower, it may not be great for the winery. And it's just a, like any industry, it ebbs and flows, and the economy has impacts on it. But sure, but I'm out in the vineyards during harvest. I'm in the vineyards the entire time, and the guys are processing the fruit at the winery. So the vineyard is the most important part of the process.
Sure, that's where they say the wine's being made.
Oh, yeah, it is.
And you're the sole owner, correct?
I am. I have no partners or investors. It's just me, my cat. It's not that bad. I do have a staff.
You have a few friends along the line, I imagine.
Yeah, it's just me and my cat and some friends. No, but I do have an awesome staff. I have a tasting room staff and an office manager. And the great thing is that as far as production goes, it's me and two guys in the cellar. And we just, I mean, it's amazing what the three of us can accomplish. I have one of the smallest production staffs for my production size, but we can all do all the jobs. And so, for instance, I can unload a truck and the guys can start processing it, and then I'll head out to the vineyards. And we typically bring in a night shift, and that works. But for the most part, we're the ones touching the wine and making the decisions. And
sure,
and it's pretty neat.
You are the winemaker as well.
Oh, yes, I am.
Okay, that I didn't know.
Yes.
So you really are wearing a multitude of hats. Wow, how did you get away?
No. You know, actually, my two big jobs, I am the owner, but the two big jobs I have is the winemaker and the national sales manager. And I can balance those two things. Again, since I've lowered my production size, I'm not traveling quite as much. But my big marketing strategy is that I'm traveling to states I want to visit. Thus, beautiful Wisconsin.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. Back to the vineyards themselves and the grapes you source. Is everything Sonoma, or do you get fruit from different areas?
No, I used to get fruit from Napa Valley, but
I've heard of that place.
I know, Napa Valley. Not just Napa. And I will start right now by saying I'm a huge fan of Napa. I mean, I love the winemakers over there are great. The wines are wonderful. The food is great. So I'm a little Napa cheerleader over in Sonoma County, but I stick with Sonoma County, and I'm extremely proud of the county and the varietals that we have to offer. You know, between Pinot and Chardonnay and Zin, it's pretty, you know, pretty outstanding quality.
Sure. Well, and the big difference between Napa and Sonoma is huge.
Sonoma is very, very large, and I try to stick to Russian River Valley and Dry Creek Valley, and I do a little bit of Alexander. And occasionally I'll source fruit from Sonoma Valley, but not that often. And really, the big important thing I do during harvest is I'm riding around in my car listening to country western music and checking vineyards. It is hard work. It's very hard.
And that's an interesting point. And I'm glad you brought that up because that it is hard work because other than the traffic that you can deal with in these areas, especially during tourist periods, is that you have to go to each one of these vineyards. You have to determine when you're going to pick. And that's what your entire business is based on, is that time you're going to pick, right?
Well, it is. And I mean, the physically challenging part of it is I literally grab buckets, go out to the vineyard, and the way you sample vineyards, and you can either do it with berries or clusters. I do it with clusters. You know, first of all, it gives me a really good workout.
Yeah, and, yeah, I bet.
And secondly, I think I can get a better idea if there's uneven ripening within the clusters. And I walk down a row, and every fourth vine on the right, I get a cluster, and every fourth vine on the left, I get a cluster. And pretty soon you have buckets full of grapes. I take them back to the winery. We stomp it and get a sugar and get a TA and a pH and you know, it's dragging all those buckets around. But also, you're being in the vineyard, one gets a sense of how close the grapes are or if there are any problems. And there are a lot of things that are important to physiological ripeness, such as the seeds need to be crunchy. They can't be chewy. The flavor development needs to be there. The stem should be brown. Mm. And sometimes some of those factors are there and some aren't, but there could be rain on its way, or perhaps the vineyard is starting to deteriorate. One might notice that the leaves are not on the vine anymore, and if that happens, then you're not going to get photosynthesis occurring. It's not going to be able to metabolize sugar. So there's a lot of judgment call, or common sense, yeah, as well as flavors.
Yeah, the whole idea is these are you, part of you. I mean, you're so in tune with your vineyard. That's kind of how it has to be, right?
Well, yes, and especially that's why I think it's very important to have long-term relationships with growers. I mean, I could keep changing Merlot vineyards, for instance, but once you're in a vineyard, you get to know the vineyard, and vineyards are pretty different, have different personalities going on. Sometimes it takes a vineyard is very slow ripening, and it could take, let's say, 5 days to finally get to the Brix level, or overnight, all of a sudden, it's sweet. And sometimes that's not as related to the weather as it is the soil and just the characteristic of the vineyard itself. Mm-hmm. So it's a big advantage to spend years working with the vineyard. And you also know other things. Like, for instance, I can go out to a vineyard and I know whether I have to worry about the gigantic Rottweiler that could be chasing me through the rows.
Has this happened before?
Oh, yes.
Oh,
or I have one vineyard where there are always wild pigs out there, and, you know, they're not really scary, but they sort of are. Mm-hmm. And I have other vineyards where the owners are very particular about their social functions. And so I have to be careful not to interrupt a garden party when I go out there. So vineyards are extreme. Sometimes it's a lifestyle choice and it's expensive landscaping. And mm-hmm. and sometimes it's farmers who they're counting on that income for their entire year of hard work.
Sure.
So
the boar, the wild pig, when you get a wild pig coming at you, I mean, I didn't think there was a way you could actually scare them away.
Well, they typically don't do that unless there are baby wild pigs involved.
Got it.
And
sure.
And they're just scary looking.
Yeah.
And I've seen one thing I will say about sustainable farming. I think now that we're getting more into sustainable, not necessarily organic, but less chemicals, less invasive farming, I'm starting to see a lot of wildlife. And it's pretty neat. I mean, there's nothing more satisfying than seeing a bobcat.
Sure.
In the vineyard.
Something like that'd be cool. And bobcats usually just run away from you as well. They're not
really interested
in you.
Actually, I have a Zin called Bobcat. That's one of my cult wines. It's the most popular wine.
Well, and this leads me to a question, you know, in your years, and you've been doing this a long time, any kind of interesting experiences, when you can laugh off?
Well, I've got a lot of stories.
I'm sure you
Let me pick and choose here. Now, this is a terrible story, but one year, I don't have a perfect sense of direction. And when you have a section of a vineyard, you'll get a direction from the grower and it will literally say, so walk 20 feet and you'll see a stump of wood and then you're going to turn left. And then you might see you'll see some chickens running around because they're not contained. And then you're going to want to go right again, go through a little path, and you'll see usually the cat hangs out there or whatever. And I had an experience a long time ago where I got the map and the directions, and I kept going out to the vineyard, and it wasn't ready, and they weren't doing anything. And I would call and say, listen, you need to thin this grape. You need to do this. You need to do this. And they'd say, well, we just did it. It's perfect. And I went back, oh, my gosh, you still haven't done that. I was getting very frustrated. And I finally got a friend of mine out there, and I said, you know, I'm asking these people, like, I'm trying to be nice, but they just won't do a thing. And he said, well, you know, what do they call this block? And I said, well, this is the triangle block. And he went, well, okay, why is this shaped like a rectangle? oh, my gosh. To this day.
Oops.
I know. I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. You're doing everything you were supposed to do. It's you, not me. It was terrible. So I'm a little more careful about things like that.
Yeah, no, I'll bet. And you know, you're buying fruit from someone else. Yeah, you certainly have to be very careful about that.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, I know. I still, like, mea culpa.
Yeah,
I felt
right. Terrible
about that one. But you know, they're just funny things that happen in general. And, you know, it's pretty extreme.
And you're heading pretty much right back into harvest when you get back. Am I right? Are you heading back, like, for the weekend or?
Yes, I'll be back in another week. And I think harvest is going to be probably like August 22nd or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be soon.
Are you early this year or no?
Well, last year we were extremely early and it only took 3 weeks to process everything.
Wow.
It's the craziest thing. I had a big advantage because of the labor shortage. We were picking all night long and it's better for the fruit, for the grapes to come in cold. But the vineyard managers were just trying to get in as much picking as they possibly could. And my advantage was that I only live about 5 minutes from the winery, and of course I can drive a forklift, so they'd start picking and they could call me anytime and I'd meet them and unload it.
Sure.
So it gave me, you know, it cut into my drinking, I'll tell you that. While I was sitting around waiting for the call, I was so I guess I'm not drinking for 3 weeks. But they would call me at, you know, 5 a.m. or 2 in the morning or 11 o'clock at night, but I would just go over there and get the fruit in, and when the guy showed up at 8, we'd process it. But that was a really condensed harvest. And this will be early, but it shouldn't be quite as condensed. And that was somewhat drought-related.
That's not surprising. So what are you thinking about 16? Do you have any gut feeling at this particular point about what your harvest is looking like?
Well, I think it's going to be a great harvest. And I'm very happy to say that the yields are up again. So we should get – the industry needs a correction right now. We've had some short years, and it's time to get some – more higher crop levels, and the quality hasn't suffered, but it does affect pricing and bulk wine pricing. And
I think this
will be a good correction harvest for us.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Hopefully you'll have a good year all the way around.
I think so.
Do you have a tasting room then?
I do.
I figured you did.
I do. I have a tasting room on Center Street in downtown Healdsburg. I'm the oldest downtown tasting room in the town of Healdsburg. And much to my employees' dismay, my tasting room is open every single day except Christmas Day and Thanksgiving Day. And it's not that I'm a complete slave driver, but I really think that tourists need something to do. And since we're a downtown winery, I mean, honestly, I would stay open on Thanksgiving Day and Christmas Day as well, but I need to draw the line somewhere.
Absolutely.
And really, when in the old days when I was by myself, I was at a different location a few blocks away, but, you know, I really didn't have anything to do. And I'd say, well, gosh, why don't I just sit in the tasting room on Easter and see if they show up, or New Year's Day or Christmas Eve. So we're known for being open. And again, we serve about 16 different wines, and I have a really, truly wonderful staff. And what we like to do is help people discover Healdsburg.
Sure.
And let them know about the local restaurants and things to do. And there's just so much to do. I mean, it's a great town.
Healdsburg is an awesome town. There is incredible food. There's obviously so many things to see. And it's just a darn nice place to walk around if you got the time, because it's beautiful.
It is. It is. I can't say enough nice things about my town.
Yeah.
And the big side trip is to go out to the coast. And the coast, of course, the marine layer and the coast, that's what's responsible for our fabulous grapes, especially Chardonnay and Pinot. And it's nice to go out there and eat oysters and enjoy the wild coastline that we have. Well, that's what's amazing about Sonoma County. And you know, the grapes are all, it's all planned, which is amazing. You know, the Pinot and the Chardonnay are all based on where the marine layer comes in. And we get to Dry Creek Valley, where you have Zin that needs to be hot.
Right.
That's where the mountains stop the fog line. And so it's all an interestingly planned based on geography and fog.
It's an important place for, I think, for people to go see. For the tasting room, I'm assuming then it's, you can pretty much walk in. It's not necessarily by appointment or anything like that.
It's not by appointment. We encourage appointments if it's more than six people or more. And plus, if you have an appointment, then we can, we'll sometimes take you to, we have sort of a VIP area or a special tasting and take you there. And the nice thing about Selby and downtown tasting is you can taste and you're close to world-class eating and shopping.
Yeah, that's what makes Healdsburg such a great place to visit. For our listeners who'd like to learn a little bit about you online, how would they do that?
I have a website. It's selbywinery.com.
And if they want to call for a reservation?
They would call 707-431-1288.
Great.
Is the tasting room.
Excellent. Susie, thanks for making the time on this trip to stop by our studio and to say hi and giving us a little information.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your hospitality and the hospitality of Milwaukee. It's fabulous.
Cheers. Let's drink some wine.
Oh, perfect.
Learn more by visiting selbywinery.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our intern is Eden Herbert. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2016.